Well, I feel really lucky in the order of sequence because Genevieve prepared you by talking about nontubercular mycobacterium, and so this will fit in, and then we talked a little about reprocessors and bronchoscopes. So I feel like you've been very well prepared, and so we won't have to elaborate some of the areas I'm going to talk about a little bit. When I first got to Nebraska in August of 2012, and pretty inexperienced, I was brought in on almost immediately in on an investigation that I'm going to sort of bring you up to speed. Facility in Nebraska, we'll call Facility A, had noticed in April that they were seeing more Mycobacterium chelonae and Mycobacterium abscessus positive specimens, mostly in bronchoalveolar lavage or BAL specimens. And they weren't certain if this was really an outbreak, if they were just seeing a few more. They weren't even really sure people were actually being clinically ill. Was this colonization they were seeing? It was rather uncertain. So they went ahead and launched their own investigation. I want to talk a little bit about what a bronchoscopy is, although you've mentioned it. So there's a picture of a bronchoscope up there, and you can see it's a long, flexible tube with ports and lots of areas where bacteria can hide. The bronchoscopist inserts the scope down through the trachea into the lung, and they wedge it in there pretty deep. And to get a BAL or bronchoalveolar lavage, what they'll do is they'll take sterile saline, they squirt it into that space and suck it back out through the tube, and then send it to the lab for various cultures. So there's a lot of areas in that process for contamination to be introduced. So Facility A, the first thing they did, because they were mostly seeing positive BALs, is they thought, well, let's look into that as a likely suspect. So first they went in and they watched some bronchoscopy procedures. They looked at their automated endoscope processors, or AERs, and saw how was disinfection being done. And they looked at maintenance records. And then they took several bronchoscopes and they sampled them. And what they did is after they had already been reprocessed and cleaned, they took sterile saline, squirted it down through the ports, sent those off to the lab, and then waited to see if anything would grow. And as we've already heard, it can take a long time, which makes these much more difficult to investigate. And then for the patients, they took three clinical isolates and sent them off for PFGE testing to a university in Texas. Well, what they found is, one, in observing the bronchoscopies, they found there was a multi-dose container of a topical anesthetic that was being used, and they decided maybe that wasn't a good idea to have a multi-use product, so they quit doing that. And the PFGE patterns came back, and two of them matched, but one of them was not from a bronchoscopy specimen. It was from a urine specimen on a patient who had had bile brushings done and GI procedures, but had never had a bronchoscopy. The bronchoscopes did not grow anything. They did find some irregularities in the maintenance with their AERs and preventive maintenance that they didn't detail with me, but that they had felt like they had resolved. Things kind of quieted down, and they thought their outbreak was over. But when they got the PFGE patterns, they still called our state epidemiologist just to discuss and see what else they might want to do, and that's where I was brought in. But they hadn't had any more positives from July to November and sort of thought it was all over. Then in December, they get another positive. And I should point out at this time, I'm focusing for this talk really about Mycobacterium chelonae because that's going to be our big player here. There were some other NTMs showing up periodically. But at that point, when they called in April or at December, after having had the discussion, we decided we were going to launch a joint investigation and work with them now that another one had popped up after they had made what they felt were good efforts at remediation of all their practices and procedures by their infection control people. So going back to NTMs, which you've heard a little bit about already, so we don't have to spend too much time. They're an acid-fast bacillus, which just is a means of discussing how they stain and how you can look at them. This is an example of them. A bacillus is rod-shaped. And this is actually growing in tattoo ink. So that's growing in tattoo ink. That was a different outbreak, actually. Okay. They're opportunistic pathogens. So mostly, as you've heard, they do affect immunocompromised people. But they're increasingly being recognized as pathogens at times in immunocompetent people. They grow in liquids a lot, as you've heard, waters, hot tubs. They're resistant to chlorine. They've been known to grow in certain disinfectants. So they're tough. They are tough to eradicate. In the past, healthcare-associated outbreaks have been found due to ice machines, due to AERs, bronchoscopes, laboratory contamination, hospital water supplies, Genesian violet, and as we've heard, hot tubs. So we decided our objective was, first we need to determine, is there really an outbreak going on, or is this a pseudo-outbreak? Is there any clinical infection present? Are people actually ill from this? Is there colonization? Are the rates above baseline? Non-tubercular mycobacteriums are not nationally reportable. They are reportable in the state of Nebraska. However, there are issues with that. So we wanted to, at this point, we were still considering M. abscessus, so we thought, let's see if we can determine the source of these, and of course prevent further colonization, infection, whatever's going on. So first we came up with a case definition, and ultimately we pared it down to a clinical sample positive for M. chelonae, the first positive specimen. Some of the patients had multiple positive specimens. The positive specimen source had to have come out of Facility A's laboratory during the period between 2012 through 2014. So we created a line list, got basic information, procedure types, dates, location, rooms, what kind of sample had been taken, what the result was, who the physician in the procedure was, and age of patient. And so then we calculated some background rates. How we did this is the lab, very kindly, it took a lot of effort, but they actually pulled up how many samples of fungus or for bacteria they had set up over that 5-year period. To provide us a denominator. In the numerator, this hospital fortunately has something called safety surveiller. It was an electronic lab, and they could pull out how many positives they'd had. And of course, we had pretty much all, we thought we had all the M. chelonae, but they went back a little further for us. So then I went on a site visit with the infection control team at Facility A, and we watched the bronchoscopy. We looked at the AERs, saw the logs. The infection preventionist that we were working with on this investigation really went over, again, cleaning and maintenance procedures, and I looked at maintenance records of the bronchoscopes, because I didn't put that on the other list, but also repair of bronchoscopes with non-standard parts or non-specific manufacturer parts have also been associated with outbreaks. So we were unable to conduct a medical record review, a very thorough one. Unfortunately, although the facility had the capability of allowing remote access to electronic health records and had previously done that for EIS officers, working on investigations, they had a new HIPAA person, and although they agreed to give access to the medical records, they determined the only form they would do that is there's a site where they would scan in 200, 300 page records PDF with no way of sorting through, with lots of nursing notes. It was unfortunately no practical way to review the records. I, as an experiment, I went through one record without actually reading papers and clicking, just clicking through. And it took me 45 minutes just to click through. And at that point, I determined, okay, this isn't practical. So as an alternative, what we did is we sent out to all the pulmonologists who had been doing bronchoscopies the list of the patients they'd had. The facility did this, and we asked them to say, in their clinical opinion, had this patient had a clinical infection or not with a non-tubercular mycobacterium. So that was our substitute for the medical records review, which is obviously not ideal. And then we evaluated also bronchoscope use, which bronchoscopies had been used in procedures. We also looked at, tried to look at who had been used before, what reprocessor had been used, but there aren't really records kept on what reprocessor was used prior to the procedure. So we could look and see what was one used after the procedure, but that wasn't particularly helpful. We need to know which reprocessor had been used for that bronchoscope before that procedure. And as was just mentioned, there weren't really good bronchoscopy logs. I got very fortunate, and the only reason I was able to do this is one of the physicians had happened to mention, there's one bronch tech at this facility, happened to mention, it'd be nice to keep a log, and he'd ask him something. And so this bronch tech, who did virtually all the bronchs, decided he'd keep his own log. And he had that, and he made that available. So for the period where he had been doing that, I was able to see what bronchoscope had been used on what patient. That was just luck, because it wasn't a formalized procedure. So we tracked the scope use and tried to look at what patients had been at the hospital and what areas, and attempted to track the AER use. Whoops. So we also decided we were going to do environmental sampling, and we decided to look at the AER's water supply, an ice machine that had been used in the PACU area before and after patients had their procedures. I should mention this hospital uses a singular OR room just for all bronchoscopies, and it's pretty much dedicated to that purpose. So they do them all in an OR. We melted some ice. We looked at a scrub sink near the suite or near the OR, tubing in the AERs, the filters, and one of the cleaning agents that was being used because it would be left out for gross cleaning, as has been mentioned before. So this is what an AER looks like. It's not the specific model, but it's similar. And what will happen is there's two sides in the ones this facility was using, and you kind of coil it up and put it in, and then you program it, and it does all the cleaning. And there are filters, multiple filters under there, and then but water supply comes in just from tap water, but it goes through different bacteriological filters. And so here's a filter that we got off to send off for sampling. And we sent all our samples to CDC. So ultimately what we sent was 27 patient isolates. Some were from, more isolates could come from a patient than one. So some patients didn't contribute any isolates and some contributed more than one, just because depending on the availability and the growth of the isolates. And 32 environmental specimens for PFGE testing. So, what we found was 36 people as of mid-2014 had a M. chelonae or M. chelonae M. abscessus complex infection. The median age was 66 with a range of 1 to 89 years. Most of these were in BALs, but there was urine, there was a tracheal aspirate, there was ear fluid, bone marrow, blood. So we had multiple positive specimens. And at this point, as time progressed, the talk says two facilities, an adjoining facility that is run completely separately but shares the laboratory began having positive specimens as well. And see, we started to we had picked up notice because we realized some of the patients that we were getting positive samples on, their samples had come from outside. They had never had any hospitalizations or procedures at Facility A. This is what the epidemic curve looked up through the end of 2013. And you can see it would, just as we had seen before, it kind of starts and sputters and you have gaps, but then it tends to cluster together a little bit. And at the end of December, what wasn't added was there were additional 5 cases in 2014. This goes through because this is where we presented all our recommendations to the facility. Okay. So here's the 5-year review we did. As we determined, we were able to quite clearly see that the rate of non-tubercular mycobacterium positive cultures was definitely increasing. And we had denominators, and we talked to the facility, and they had not had an increased workload either. So we trust that this had been going on for at least 5 years. And we went a little further back, and it really clearly started in 2008. Nothing significant in bronchoscope use. I had a p-value of like less than 0.01. There was no difference in what we could tell. But what we did see on the site survey was that non-sterile ice from the ice machine was being brought in, which you should never do. You shouldn't use non-sterile ice for any pharmaceutical project, product, including sterile saline. And in the laboratory area, plants had been found. So we finally got our PFGE results. And to our surprise and delight, because as I understand this isn't all that common, we actually found direct matching between environmental samples relating back to water. Now, cluster A, the gold is facility B. That's the second facility that started showing up later. They had a very closely matching isolate to two bronch patients at facility A, the ice machine at facility A, and the water supply to the Medivators, which is the brand of AER that this facility was using. So cluster A was the one where we had direct matching between the patients and the environmental samples. And then we had cluster B, where we had directly matching and very closely related patient samples that did not match environmental samples. So we actually had two little clusters going on, and this is all M. chelonae. So we were surprised because we had a kind of a smoking gun, so we were pretty happy. We also got some other positive samples that did not relate at all of M. chelonae and a few other non-tubercular mycobacterium from other places, but they weren't directly related. So one of the things that can be really challenging is it can be very difficult to distinguish between colonization, lab contamination, and active infection. And that's something we struggled with throughout. And the hospital continuously pointed out if somebody's not getting sick, we're not going to worry about it too much. There's a lot of tension there. Patients undergoing bronchoscopies have underlying lung pathology. That's why they're undergoing the bronch. So it's like, was it there? Is it colonized? So I'm not going to read this whole thing because I'm getting short on time, but American Thoracic Society has clear definitions on how you diagnose pulmonary NTMs. And they require you to have x-ray findings. You can see cavitary lesions there. Because I wasn't able to do a complete medical review, I had to completely take, I took the clinician's determination that they, none of their patients had had active disease, with the exception of Facility B, two children were treated and did have clinical disease. So then we became very concerned, but we made sure Facility B was aware of everything we had done to this point, and they have not requested us to come in and assist, so I have no additional information on them, but they're completely aware of these findings. So what we determined was probably there's a biofilm in the water system. This makes sense with everything that's going on, because what happens is the mycobacterium builds up, it grows, and then occasionally flakes off, which would explain sort of the sporadic nature of the events and the little outbreaks, because we'd get people very closely clustered in time. And it would be intermittent, and then it regrows. They're very, very, very difficult to eradicate, very resistant to chlorine. So basically, frequently, no sources found in investigations. We found two clusters, one linked to the environmental samples, and then we saw a lot of heterogeneity. So this was consistent with it being from a tap water source. So in conclusion, the patterns matched. Likely source was the hospital water system, probably from a biofilm. Uncertain, though, how it was getting in. Was it getting into the samples? Was it in the bronchoscope somewhere? We still don't know exactly where the water crossed over to get into the samples or the patients. So that remains a bit of a mystery, although there were two patients with clinical illnesses, both of whom had central lines, and so that is a, can be a potential source of contamination if tap water is used, if they shower. So we made a lot of recommendations, but mostly we told them they needed to conduct a risk assessment. They had to follow guidelines for environmental infection control. The big one and the hardest one for the facility is we really wanted 0.2 micron filters because those are bacteriological filters. The ice machine, the filter in, is a 0.5, and basically I've been told the NTMs kind of wave at it as they go by. The ice machines weren't being properly disinfected, the same sort of things we've discussed. We told them not to store pharmaceuticals on non-sterilized. So they followed some of our recommendations and not either. And these are basically since I'm about out of time here, we're in more detail, but what I've just told you. But these 2.2, which can protect against Legionnaires and other things, are very expensive. They have to be changed more frequently, and they're a real problem. So basically, what they did is they removed some aerators that could spray water from the faucets. They replaced their ice machine. They did place a bacteriological filter to the ice machine. They went ahead. This was not part of our recommendation. They actually replaced all their bronchoscopes with the kind that does not have to be used in an AER, and that they can decontaminate without using automated reprocessors because they felt they had more control over that because they kept coming back to thinking it was the AERs, but we don't have real clear evidence. And they changed their cleaning procedures. So that was really fast, but I can't acknowledge the individuals at Facility A per their request except to say that they did all the work. They really did a lot of the investigation, and we really appreciate what they did. And it's a difficult problem for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. We have time for a question. If anybody has one?
Yep. Hi, I'm Kelsey Young from Los Angeles County. Actually, the question for both you and Genevieve, if that's okay. We're currently investigating NTM situation has gone back to 2010 in a plastic surgeon's office. So I feel your pain. Given that quite a few of these infections occur outside of inpatient settings, in outpatient settings and in medical tourists, given that NHSN is not always sensitive to this because of its limitations in reporting, how do you find your NTM reportable? How do you find those results? Has that been useful for you?
So for us, I mentioned it's reportable in Nebraska. The problem is it wasn't getting reported because we have an electronic system and the filters at the hospital have to, the IT people have to go in and set it up so that, since it's not standard, so that it forwards those reports to the state. So that was not happening. After this, we think we've gotten that resolved because it had been reportable. So for us, that's one method. Other than that, we relied totally on the hospital for case finding, and they use an automated system as well, so their infection preventionists were wonderful and could immediately pull out, and now they're watching very closely, obviously. Without an automated system or the hospital really watching, I'm not really sure. Maybe Genevieve has a different answer.